the vision today is to unlock the connection between humans and animals for a better world.
That's Craig Piggott, the founder of Halter, and this is Wild Hearts. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Wild Hearts, a podcast dedicated to sharing the real stories of founders, the passionate few taking giant leaps forward. We're here to uncover the lessons from the founders looking to change the world and the investors who back them. This podcast is brought to you by the team at Blackbird, and I'm your host, Mason Yates. A day in the life of a dairy farmer consists of a 4:30 a.m. wake up every day, 365 days a year. Farmers must then move their cows from paddock to paddock. All the while, they must be acutely attuned to the animal's needs. Hundreds and thousands of individual cows with a different temperament. It's almost an impossible task. Our next guest, Craig Piggott, grew up on a dairy farm where he saw his parents put in 80-hour weeks just to keep up. Determined to improve the lives of his parents and dairy farmers all around the world, he co-founded Halter. Halter is a fenceless farming startup. My favorite way of describing what Halter does is that they are mind control technology for cows. They've developed an IoT wearable collar that uses Pavlovian conditioning to safely teach the cow to move in response to different signals, like vibrations and sounds, that are triggered by the collar. The technology has even enabled one farming family to control their New Zealand dairy farm from France. It's literally a life-changing device for farmers. In today's episode, you'll hear from the incredible storyteller Craig on the future of farming and a bunch of other actionable tips to create a culture of radical honesty. We'll also hear from Halter's very first believer and the founder of one of the most ambitious companies in the world, Rocket Lab. Peter Beck talks about some of the biggest mistakes made by New Zealand entrepreneurs and what convinced him to invest in Halter. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did. Craig's up first, followed by Peter. Enjoy.
Well, let's kick it off right at the beginning.
Yeah.
What was it like growing up on a farm?
Yeah, good question. It was good, actually. I often wonder how I could recreate such a childhood for, like, I don't have kids at all, and they're not in the planning stages at all. But when I do have kids, I've often wondered, like, how I would try and recreate the experience of growing up on a farm. I think it's just, yeah, so broad. You're not really constrained by anything at all. Like, there's no kind of rules or anything. It's just very much like yourself and the land and, like, tasks to get done as such. So I loved it. Yeah, kind of taught me a lot of things. Used to work, like, pretty hard. Like, instills, I think, a lot of life principles in you growing up on a farm. When you want something and, like, you kind of have all the abilities to achieve it if you just set your mind to it, if that makes sense. Mm. If you want to buy a car, cool, that's fine. Like, do some work. Like, it's right there. You can do it whenever you want, as many hours as you want.
Just get outside.
Like, yeah. And so it was pretty classic, actually. Grew up in a household. We didn't have a TV. We didn't have PlayStations or anything like that. Didn't spend any time inside. It was always just, like, outside, kind of solving problems with what you had around you.
What were some of your earliest memories then?
On a farm? Good question, actually.
Paint the picture of, like, am I seeing you on a horse right now? Are you building something?
Yeah, actually. No, I've only ridden a horse a couple of times.
Are you driving at, like, 12 years old?
Oh, yes, definitely. Actually, that's a good example. We were shifting, everyone shifts like farms on the 1st of June. And I would have been maybe 12 or 13. And somehow we just got the logistics a bit wrong. And myself and my best friend, who was also like 12 or 13, were left on the old farm with this ute, this diesel ute that, like, firstly had no battery. We couldn't start it. We had to get, I think it was a neighbor to push start us with the tractor. And then we had to drive it like 30 minutes across the Waikato to our new farm. And my parents had already, like, left. And so you're trying to solve these problems on the fly. And then you find yourself, yeah, driving, trying to avoid all the main roads and driving to a new block at like 13 years old, I think we were. You can't stall it, like, because you can't start it. Yeah, it wouldn't idle. A whole lot of light problems. So you just spend your whole time
amazed that you knew what any of those things were at 13 years old.
Yeah, you learn that stuff pretty early, to be fair, on a farm. Yeah.
What even led you to work at Rocket Lab?
It was pretty, like, growing up on a farm, I was always kind of fixing stuff and building things, and I was always fascinated with, like, automation. Actually, when I was a child, I thought I was going to be someone that designed factories. I really liked that concept of, like, you could build something and it could do this one thing, like, thousands of times, and you could, like, walk away and it would keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And that, it just, I guess it's awesome, almost the notion of being leveraged. Like, I just loved that from a young age. And so I studied engineering, kind of still with that in mind a little bit. I studied mechanical engineering, but then pretty quickly Rocket Lab was really just like the dream job, like, especially within New Zealand and even around the world now. But that was, I didn't know much about, like, startup. I didn't know anything about startups. I didn't know anything about the culture. It was just a big problem and they all seemed to work pretty hard, and I knew I could work hard, and I went on to work at Rocket Lab. And so that's kind of, I guess, the why.
And what exactly were you doing there?
So I, funnily enough, actually, Pete was, Pete doesn't know this, but I applied to Rocket Lab in my first year of uni for an internship. I put on a shirt, took my CV, and I had all these projects I'd done. I'd built 3D printers. I had restored cars. I had, like, built automated, like, feeding systems for animals. These were all as a teenager. And so I went and knocked on the door and gave them my stuff. And I just was, like, very underprepared and wasn't expecting on the spot for someone to open the door and then just give me, like, a speed interview. I gave them my CV and they just started, like, just load, like, laying into me with questions. And I was like, whoa, I was not ready for that. And I would have been, I don't know, 19 at the time.
What was in the speed interview?
Just a bunch of questions about, like, what I knew about rockets and why I wanted to work.
Really putting it on you.
Yeah, just, like, on the spot. The only questions I could answer properly, like, can you work hard? Like, what's the hardest you've worked in your life? And I was like, man, I got this one wrapped up. But
when I was 13, I restarted a car.
And so, yeah, I grew up, like, I don't know, plowing paddocks 24, 30 hours straight, like, all that kind of stuff. I had heaps of that, but no, so I didn't get the job. And then Pete was coming to speak at university and I was like, sweet, I'm going to go along and get a job, was kind of the goal. Mm-hmm. And hung around and ended up talking to him afterwards and then about some separate stuff, but managed to, after about a year of knowing Pete, convince him to hire me. And so I started at Rocket Lab working directly for Peter Beck. And it was, yeah, a pretty surreal experience. This was before their first launch. We were 50, 60, 70 people. And I kind of just started off, yeah, doing a bunch of all sorts of different things, kind of wherever Pete, like, needed help the most. And so, yeah, it was an unreal experience. I think I learned more my year at Rocket Lab than I learned at my 4 years at university.
Wow, yeah.
And I stand by that.
So, what do you think were top 1 to 3 things that you really lean on at Holter? Or just generally, what are the top 3 things that you've learned from there?
Top 3 things. First one was just that, like, you walked in the door and it felt different. Like, every single person there was, like, incredibly driven, was, like, determined to make a difference. And, like, the energy, I guess, or the feeling that you could kind of do anything was like so powerful. And so that you could maybe summarize as the culture. I'm not sure how you'd want to summarize that, but that was probably the first thing. And that was, I'd never felt anything like that. And so that was incredible. The second thing was probably, like, the ambition from Pete himself and also a lot of other people there. Like, I'm starting a rocket company in New Zealand and I don't care if you think I'm crazy, like, I'm doing it. Like, there's not even a doubt in my mind that I'm going to do this. And that was, like, there's nothing more inspiring than someone who's, like, that bold and that determined to, like, make it happen. So that was incredible. And the third thing would just be, that was my like, the window into kind of the startup world, or this high growth world. Like, hold on, you can go convince venture capitalists to give you money for, like, an idea. And then not only does it come with money, it comes with all of this expertise and this guidance. And then you can go around and, like, hire all these top people from, like, all around New Zealand or the world even. And you assemble, like, this kind of this crew to go tackle this ambitious problem. Like, that was just fascinating to me. And I from that moment on, I knew I would never, ever work in like a big corporate. I was like, I will never do anything but startups. This is incredible. I love it.
So you had the startup itch, so to say. And
yep.
when did you first have an idea to start your own company?
My parents are self-employed because they are dairy farmers. And with this notion of being leveraged, I always wanted to build something that would be far bigger than me. And that was probably what I was trying to solve for. I loved my time at Rocket Lab, and it was really, really hard to leave, especially before the first flight. You know, it's kind of naturally you want to see that rocket fly. But yeah, it was really at Rocket Lab that it just kind of picked up momentum, this feeling. It was like, hold on, now I have, there's literally no excuse. I know how inefficient and like wrong a whole lot of farming is, and I know how I could solve this. And from an engineering perspective, and then I'm in an environment right now where they're doing like this crazy stuff, and I know how that works. And so like, I have to do it, really. I'm lying to myself if I pretend I'm not in a good spot, or I don't know how. Like, I know how to do this. I just have to do it. And so that's kind of how it started. Yeah.
Like, that's good. What was the idea?
The idea initially was just, it stemmed from the fact that farming is like, I'd say, quite misunderstood. It's like very, very, the first principles of farming are very complex. And often the people that are farming like aren't particularly good at articulating why or how, but the spreadsheets I'd see like my old man using and stuff was always blown away with. And so on top of that, they're working 80, 100 hour weeks, and they're kind of just like crying out for a better way. And it's just never been there. Like, I think because it's so complex and it's hard to understand how everything works, it's pretty rare that you get to understand that, and you get to couple it with also like the engineering know-how of how to solve it. And so that was kind of the why. Initially, Holter was setting out to try and like pretty much think about, I wanted it to be this like massive shift in farming. I didn't want it to be like an iteration or a little improvement. I wanted it to be like a ground up rebuild, I guess. And so these days we say like, if you started a farming again, what would it look like? And you get out down the first principles and you pretty quickly end up at the cow, and then you build a collar. And so that all kind of makes sense. But it was very focused around the cow. It was very focused around doing what's better for like the cow, what's better for the farmer and their mental health, and also what's better for like the, like your production. It had to make sense from a bottom line perspective and from a labor perspective. So that was kind of initially, very simply, it was virtual fencing. This is one of the biggest things on a farm. Everything on a farm is to control the location of a cow. And I'm pretty sure we could train cows to do this. We're already doing it with dogs, and farmers will like kind of speak to their cows in the cow shed to like move them up the bales. And there's already hints of this all around. It was just putting it into a centralized system.
And so how did you think you could do it with cows though?
We didn't really know, to be honest. I had like this hunch, and naturally I was like, well, I'll try and build a collar and I'll just give it a go. I think this is actually something you see these days in the rocket industry, is it's actually, there's not that many like rocket scientists around anymore. Like, a lot of it's just like rocket engineering. It's the tools we have on hand are so powerful, and computers are so powerful, and simulation so good, that you can really like build it, test it, and iterate. Like, you just, instead of thinking heaps about it, just do it. And so we kind of took that philosophy, I guess, and just set up to build some hardware, write a bunch of firmware, and just see if we could get a cow to understand a bunch of cues that we were going to use to train it with.
Talk about a day in the life of a farmer. And what's your relationship like with farmers, and how do you build around that?
A day in the life of a farmer before Holter or after Holter?
Before Holter, or at least when you go to a farm and they don't know who Holter is, or maybe they've heard about Holter from their friend.
Yeah, a day in the life of a farmer. So it is, I still spend a lot of time with farmers. My parents are still running a dairy farm. And I have a huge amount of admiration for like what farmers do and the problems they solve and kind of the people that they are. A day in a life, well, you're up at 4:30 pretty much every morning, no matter what, Christmas Day, raining, and I don't know, there's a thunderstorm, like nothing waits for you. That's actually something that farming teaches you, is just like outrageous amount of resilience and grit. You just got to keep going no matter what. So you're up at 4:30, you're like going to get the cows in, you are setting up new breaks or like allocations of feed, you walk hundreds of cows, usually you're walking into like a milking shed or a milking parlor or a cow shed. You often have a couple groups, a couple herds of cows, you milk them. It's kind of, you finish that process at about 7. That's kind of the almost the start of where the actual work happens, when you go out and there's a whole lot of like farm walking and strategic decisions to make and planning ahead and looking at the weather and trying to work out where you'll put the cows tomorrow and the next day and how much feed to give them, if you're going to like slow that down or speed it up, or how the cows are looking. There's kind of all these decisions you're always making. You're taking in like hundreds of different kind of inputs. And so there's kind of that piece. You do the milking process all again in the afternoon. It's calving season. And so there's a bit like baby calves around. You are checking on this herd consistently. Like it is 11 o'clock at night. You've been up since 4:30. You've done a whole day of work. You'll go. You usually don't even have time for breakfast. You'll get home for the first time around midday. You'll have lunch. You might get like an hour at home, if that. And then, yeah, you finish milking. And then it's 11 at night and you're back out in a paddock with a torch, like checking on all your like cows or all your girls as such, trying to like make sure they're all okay. No one's having any issues. They're all calm. And then you go back to bed. And if there's an issue, if there's a cow that's having trouble calving, then you'll walk that cow to the shed and you'll try and assist. And you could be there for 2 hours helping this cow to calve. And so farmers like care so much about their animals and about the land, and like they work like ridiculously hard, and there's all these things they know that they should be doing and like they wish they could do. But it's just like, mate, when it's like 11 at night and you've already clocked up like 100 hours, like you just don't have time to like do that. So yeah,
that is one of the most relentless jobs.
It is like unforgiving. And that's like, also you learn when you're a farmer, you don't talk a lot. And so I think up until just recently in construction, it was the worst like mental health rates in industry. So
wow.
It's pretty lonely. It's, you can easily work months on end without leaving the farm. I think my old man, when he first started farming, he'd go like 3 months and his car wouldn't leave the garage. Like, his manager slash boss would, they'd go to his house for lunch and dinner. And so he was up at 4:30 working all the way through to the night, and then, you know, do it again tomorrow. And so, yeah, it's a pretty grounding experience as a kid. Like, you definitely instills like a core set of values I don't think I would have had any other way. So.
No way. Wow. And let's compare that with a day in the life with Holter.
Yeah, well, that's quite different, which is cool. So everything on a farm, every fence, race, gate, dog, bike is there to control the location of a cow. And the core principles of farming are always changing. They're very complex. And the tools, those race, dog, bike things, are very primitive and rigid, and it's hard to use them to actually like hit these principles. And so Holter kind of fills that gap. So we can virtually fence cows, we can shift them anywhere at any time from anywhere in the world. We can allocate down to the precise like meters squared rather than a whole paddock or a fraction, like a half paddock, which is still pretty rough. We have hardware on every cow that has solar panels, and so we're collecting so much information about these cows that you don't have to go out at 11 o'clock at night to check on this herd. Like, we will tell you when there's an issue. And so, because most of the time you go out there at 11 at night or whatever, checking on your cows that are about to calve, and there's no issues. They're completely fine. So you're doing all this work for kind of no reason in a way, or for peace of mind, really. And when you've got like a sensor on every single cow that understands all of their behaviors, what they're doing, how that changes, we can pick up things like calving hours before they go into labor, just through behavior changes, sicknesses. Cows are stoics, so actually they hide little things from you as well, or they hide them visually. So like a cow won't visibly limp until her hoof or her foot is really, really bad. But, you know, a few days before that or a few weeks before that, she will walk less. And so that's very clear in the data. Or she'll eat less because she's spending less time standing. And so that, we like, when you look at data, is super clear. But as a farmer, good farmers will be able to pick it up loosely. But even then, you've got 400 cows, and you're trying to keep an eye on all of them. It's pretty difficult, right? One farmer with two eyes keeping an eye on 400 cows compared to a sensor on every, like a Fitbit on every single cow, monitoring every single movement. So there's a whole like monitoring piece. You never have cows in rivers, obviously, or any sensitive environment. That's easy. Not only that, we can prove it to you. We can show you the data. The whole health of the herd is up. They don't have to be in these 400 cow groups or 1,000 cow groups. They could be in 20 groups of 20. And they can roam kind of wherever they want. You pull out all your fences. Well, that's what you move towards. And you've got this big open meadow, effectively, where these cows are grazing wherever. You're kind of tweaking where they're grazing, so they're going to the right grass. So you're still running a very efficient farm. And then come like 4 a.m. or 5 a.m, all the afternoon, you spin them around, bring them back to the shed, let them back out again. And so you kind of get to emulate the wild, really, yet you're still running a more efficient system because there's not these fences in the way. So it's kind of the best of both there. And you can do it from anywhere in the world, really. So that's a pretty powerful thing as well.
Incredibly powerful. And what have been some of the major learnings that you've shared or you've taken away from farmers maybe in the last year as you've begun selling to customers?
What are some of the major learnings? It's a good question. I think one of the major things we've learned is how resourceful, and that you kind of know this, they fix things with the tools they have around them all the time. But you never can imagine how resourceful these people are until you give them stuff they've never seen before. Like you give them a whole new system to run their farm. And then every day we log into this data we have, and we're like, what's going on there? And they've found some like creative way to solve a problem that you had never even set out to do. And you're like, well, oh, that's smart. That's like, and so a good example would be when after you've milked the cows, you want to let them all go to the paddock at the same time. So even the like quieter, more timid cows get the same opportunity to eat because they come out last. Otherwise, if you let all the like dominant cows go first, they eat all the food. Mm. So you hold them at the shed. You usually hold them on like a pad, but they're standing on like either concrete or like the race, which is more of a metal. And so that's not good for their hooves. So you don't want to do that too much. But if you let them go to the paddock, they eat the grass. So farmers actually start sending their cows back to the paddock, but they'll hold them in the old break, the old zone where they've already eaten. And then as soon as the last cow enters, they just flick one button and shift them, that herd, across the break into the new grass. And so they all get, and so like in terms of better like welfare on like their hooves, and they're not standing on concrete for ages, and there's no drop in efficiency. And so like that's a really simple example. There's definitely some more complex ones, but that one, we never even thought of that, but that's pretty smart. And so yeah, there's a whole lot. I'd say our farmers are coming up with new stuff and new problems to solve at a rate almost comparable to us. So yeah, and then it's good, we productize some of them we're like, yep, that's valuable, but we'll get to that later. And so I'd say we're learning a lot about like the system as they start to use it.
One of the biggest variables, and you can kind of you sense it in the comparison, is just how much time you can save in a farmer's life. Do you have any stories of how someone's lives might have changed after using Holter?
Yeah, there's a couple of stories. Definitely you shave out like hours of the day, and often at like some pretty crazy times, early in the morning and also in the heat of the sun in the afternoon. Cows are walking kilometers, for instance. Probably when you look at time, it's these two pieces. There's the quantity of the time, and then there's the quality of that time. And so what we're finding is we are saving time, and quite a lot of it, but we are giving farmers like peace of mind. So all the rest of the work, they have way less stress when they're doing it. They know, like when they're at home with their family, they know that all the cows are in the paddock and there's not any cows on the road, or there isn't any sick cows, or like it's all that information is there at any point. If you're worried, you pull your phone out, have a look. No, it's fine. Put your phone back in. And so that I think is, and actually probably a good example would be like, you know, when you come home from like a crazy day at work and you're super stressed, and everybody around you knows that, like your friends, your family, your partner, like they know that you're just not in the headspace. Your brain's mush. You can't even, you're not even a human like at that point. Oh, and Yeah, literally. And so kind of solving that has been incredible, I think. I think for like the families of that all live there on the farm, like the quality of life is just is a massive improve. We have one customer who lives in France and he used to live in New Zealand.
Their farm's in New Zealand?
Yeah, their farm's in New Zealand. And after using Halter for, wasn't very long at all, they bought a house in France and moved the whole family across. That was incredible for we like that was yeah such a good story, especially after years of R&D and trying to solve problems and trying to get the reliability up. It's a mission critical system, like yeah, people worked pretty hard and having just that like that little touch point of like wow, we're genuinely changing people's lives here is super exciting. And so yeah, that combined with the fact they're using it all the time, they do everything they possibly could do with it. The feedback's always, yeah, super powerful. And the, like, we're really just getting started. Like the core system's there and like the feature requests and the critical things we could do that provide huge value, which we just can't, like we just haven't got to yet. Like, yes, we know. We know that's like a massive problem and we'll get to it. Like it's in the list of things to do. And so, yeah, it's quite, I think it's quite refreshing for a lot of farmers. It's a completely different take from what they're used to in the industry.
How has the mission or vision evolved since, I guess, 4 years ago now?
It's evolved a lot. We've never pivoted. We've always been very pure about what we've set out to do, but it has grown massively. It definitely was quite focused around the dairy cow kind of initially, and there's a lot of cows and the problem's massive to solve. But pretty quickly we realized like, whoa, this is what we're building here can apply to any animal or really any conscious being. So the whole layer, well, humans are very susceptible to Pavlovian conditioning, like happens all the time, but the whole layer between humans and animals is like, that gap right now is incredibly big. Like you know, people have domestic dogs, but they know very little about like the behavior of that dog and what certain things mean, and the dog knows very little about what you're trying to get it to do aside from some basic commands like sit and maybe roll over and like that a lead equals a walk. And really the big gap there is just repetition, right? It's just a piece of technology that can translate your intention and be perfect at it and do it 24/7 and there's no variance. And so, you know, software is pretty good at this. And so that's kind of where the vision today is, to unlock the connection between humans and animals for a better world.
Wow. And if we rewind back in year one, you obviously have to test this, iterate it, build it.
Yep.
It's hardware. Mm-hmm. Run us through what it was like testing this on a cow.
That was, yeah, looking back, it was pretty hardcore. Like in the space of 12 months, this is before we raised any money, we knew we were going to have to be able to at least like show we could move a cow before we went out and raised money. Yeah. Otherwise we just sounded crazy. And so I think we would have built upwards of 20 different versions of hardware, which that by itself is like a bit of a feat in a year when you've got no money and also, yeah, like you don't really know what you're doing. Probably 20 versions of hardware. We drove from Auckland down to my family farm in the Waikato. I would have lost count of how many weekends we would have like pulled an all-nighter the days before to get the hardware ready, to then finish the code, to try and debug it, to drive it all the way to farm. And then, I don't know, for it to crash for like 8 hours continuously, you just can't keep the thing running, or you put it on a cow and it crashes, or it starts to rain and it's not waterproof, or the cow just has no idea what you're trying to do. Just the algorithms aren't good enough or aren't sophisticated enough at that point. And so, yeah, there was a lot of long drives home from the farm at midnight on a Sunday, feeling pretty sorry about all this effort you'd put in. And it'd take a lot to like pick yourself back up off the ground and do it again kind of week after week until you got these little hints that you're like, hold on, that was something there. Like that cow responded, flicked their head, or like, we're getting somewhere here. And so, and once you get that, like when you've been going for months on nothing, just the sniff that you are going the right way is
cause
like,
effect. I've seen it. Yeah. Write it down.
Yeah, it's incredibly motivating. Yeah,
Oh my gosh. And so after 12 months, 20 iterations, what was it like after you had landed on something that was clearly working?
Well, it was only just like working. Kind of had this mantra in my head, which was like, this thing should fail pretty much the day that we raise money. Like not Holter, just to be clear, the hardware,
yes,
the system, yeah, the engineering system. And so I knew every single line of code I was writing was bad code, but that was fine. And so really we pulled it all together just enough to get enough data to get like all our purchases and stuff together to pretty much close our seed round. And then we threw away everything and started again. We were like, cool, we know the principles. We kept the core algorithm, but we hung up the collar. And it was not saying I'm proud of from a workmanship point of view. It's pretty messy piece of hardware, but hung that up, pretty much deleted all the code and started fresh, started hiring.
Please tell me that's hanging up in the office somewhere.
It was hanging somewhere. I think we did a big clean out and I'm not sure where it is now, but yeah, there's heaps of old hardware around.
That's awesome. For sure.
We've built many more versions since then.
And what was it like emotionally knowing that you needed to get rid of it, or was it just
really... like you're always looking ahead, right? So I didn't even, you don't even really think about it. There's no like sentiment, what's the word? There's no kind of feelings of like, oh, that's sad. Like you're so busy trying to land like your first hire or trying to close this office or negotiate down a 5-year lease. You're like, hold on, 5 years? Like, no way. 6 months? Like, I don't know if we'll fit it here in 6 months' time. And so, yeah, you never have time to really stop and look back. And I think that's probably a good, most of the time, that's a good thing. I think that can get quite tiring for your team sometimes if you just never stop, quite like mission focused. That's actually feedback I got from my team just recently in a 360. Was like, sometimes just like the mission focus is like, it's incredible, but you seem to like stop and a little bit of empathy and a little bit of, yeah, would be incredible, so.
I mean, that's really good feedback. And I mean, good for everyone to hear.
Yeah.
We all get so caught up.
Yeah, we are huge believers in feedback. Someone said a line the other day, I wrote it down in my book. It was, things unsaid is as bad as lying. And I was like,
things unsaid is as bad as lying.
Yeah. If you have an opinion, like a valid opinion about something and you don't say it, you're pretty much lying. And so, yeah, it is, I think it's like an incredible one. So especially in a fast paced like environment, which is you're doing a whole lot of stuff no one's done before, like you need everybody to be very direct and very honest. And, you know, interns need to be able to come up to me and give me feedback like live on the spot if they think I'm doing something wrong. And so, yeah, it's all part of kind of building the right culture, I guess.
Well, let's talk about building the right culture at Holter. What are some of the values that you stand by?
Well, so we've got 7 values. We went through actually a bit of an exercise with the team. We got everybody into a room to pretty much put down like, what is the dream environment you want to operate in as such? We mapped them all down and put them on the wall and kind of paired them with a few things which we aspired to be. And so we landed with 7 values: team over talent, speed matters, we're pioneers, hunger over experience, act like a CEO, don't compromise the future, and farms come first. And so, and we kind of have little like precedents that go with them, and we try and explain them. We do, I know a lot of companies have values and they're on the wall and you kind of like pay lip service to them. I think we genuinely like live and breathe these. Like, these are ones that we, you know, we use them as much as possible to make every decision. We refer to them all the time. We have like a formal roles in the company called a culture lead, where we have put, I guess it's like a stamp on their back that says like, hey, these people are great examples of our values. Like if you wanted a walking, living, breathing example that you could look at and be like, oh, I could be more like that, these are the people. And so
employee of the month, is it?
No, this is a formal job title that gets added to your like JD, or added to your contract.
Oh,
so
wow.
You can be like, we've got a head of hardware and culture lead and a lead front end developer and culture lead. And we've actually just added 3 more, and it's about a 12 to 18 month stint. You kind of roll on and then we induct new ones and then you roll off and you kind of join the like culture lead alumni. and you do hiring screens and interviews. You hold like leadership to account on the culture. It's like this focus of like, hey, we want to spend just as much time talking and thinking and designing the culture as we do our product. And this is a really like neat way that we can do that.
Who's someone who comes to mind that was a culture lead, and how did they live and breathe the values of Holter? And maybe give us an example. You don't have to. I'd just love to hear sort of how that actually came to fruition. And
so the start of the culture leads, I think we were trying to, it's kind of that notion of like, it's what you do that matters, not what you say. It's like, well, who does it the best? I'm like, why don't we just formalize that? Why don't we say this? Why can't everybody be more like this person, or the values of this person at least? And so that was how like the culture lead thing started. Probably a good example of how like culture-based decision-making works, or what it relies on is kind of people over process, or removing, or context over control, pretty much. So you remove all the controls. So you don't really have that many approvals or like systems or anything like that. And instead you replace it with context and like a shared set of beliefs. And so a really good example that comes to mind is we run all our production in China. And this was pretty early days. We had a couple engineers over there, and we had an issue that cropped up, and the whole line like ground to a halt because this one component fell out of spec, and we couldn't, like the whole factory was there working on, they couldn't work out how to, like why, pretty much the root cause to this falling out of spec. And so this is like all, this guy would have been 22 or 23 at the time, and he just packs his suitcase full of these electronic components. I think he packed like 2 or 3 suitcases. He hops on the next flight home. He has to somehow get them through like customs and the border. He comes straight from the airport, Auckland airport, into the office. He didn't even pack any clothes. Into the office, there's a team waiting here. They work like through the night. They pretty much work out what's wrong. They fix these like suitcases full of components. They pack the bags back. He hops on the next plane, goes straight back to China, gets them somehow back through customs, not sure how, and to the factory, and then the line starts again. And it's all within the space of like a few days, a couple of days maybe. And it's all like, you know, no one said, there was no, hey, can I buy this flight? It's going to cost this much money. It's like, I know this is important. I know that cost is irrelevant to the cost of production being down. Like I can make all these calls on the ground, and I know that this aligns with our values. Speed matters, like as a good, we are pioneers. And so like, I'm confident that I'm making the right decisions here. And so, yeah, as a result, you get like that kind of stuff. I guess a lot of companies could easily be, you know, weeks in an investigation, and wouldn't even want to think about how that would go, but it's probably a good example. He's actually a culture lead as well, by the way.
Do you have another example? That's amazing, by the way. That is such a cool story. Do you have another example of context over control? I love that idea.
The best way I can, what would be the best example? So Netflix have this principle, which is like a tree versus a top-down pyramid. And so actually this is why startups exist. You know, why does a startup have any right to compete with a big corporate? Like it's, you know, we all know in the startup world why, but like, from a first principles perspective, that seems crazy. Like from a, they've got so much more resource, so much more like money, people, everything. And so customers, and I think it breaks down to a simple thing, which is like trying to please your boss pretty much. Like in a top-down pyramid, like the CEO sets like some strategic initiatives and everybody kind of like shuffles under that, and they all try to like pile up to hit some metric. And you could be the engineer on the ground implementing something. And how many times have those people been like, man, this is stupid. Like, the system's not ready for this. Like, it's just, and you do it because you're like, well, this is like what my boss wants. And so everybody's kind of like pretty much misaligned, right? You're not doing what's the right thing for the company. You're doing what's the right thing, like politically, to get a promotion or to move up, or because you're trying to make your boss look good. And so this notion of a tree is, instead of having top-down like control and policy and initiatives, your senior management are the trunk of the tree, and their job is just to share as much context as possible. And then the branches are like your managers, and then right at the edge of the branches, like the thin branches, are your individual contributors, and they're the people that have all the information. Like they're the ones that are receiving all the inbound information, or the results off the ground, and they have all the context. And so they actually are in a far better position to make like the calls and the decisions. And so I think the key thing is that you should never really, I shouldn't really be making many decisions on the whole. I should just be sharing context and then allowing people to make those decisions. And then the results will speak for themselves, right? And so that's a hard concept to get, and it relies very heavily on having a high density of talent. You can't have people like within the organization that aren't able to cope with that much freedom, because that will just ruin, that will grind the whole machine to a halt. But yeah, it's the tree analogy is phenomenal. I think that's amazing. I think it outlines like how you should position yourself as like as a CEO or as a senior manager. And I think it's actually very like, I'd like to say that I'm incredibly intelligent and I could work this out for myself, but you almost don't have any other option when you're a young founder. Like, I can't pretend to be this like 30-year-old, 30 years experience in the industry. I'm making all these great decisions. Like, no. I'm just here to provide context and like get out of your way and let you make the decision. And if you hire the right people, then the results will, you know, will follow. And so that's been, I think that's the best way to think about context versus control. And I think that's fundamentally why startups are able to achieve so much relative to often like big corporations that are like struggle to move at that pace.
And if we, so one of the ideas in that sort of attacks hierarchy, do you have any thoughts about hierarchy and how you scale that?
We have very little hierarchy. And, you know, this is like everybody, most people know that startups wear t-shirts and hoodies and whatnot. And there's actually a good reason for that. And a lot of people
pardon? One of our values, we wear t-shirts.
Yeah, wear a t-shirt. Yeah, it is. And most people just think it's because like, oh yeah, that's cool. But it's actually because you don't want the most senior person with the flashiest suit to have the loudest voice, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is like we call it an idea meritocracy or however you want to frame it. But that is like a good example of something that you can do to try and remove like this rigid hierarchy. We right now run a very flat structure, which is, we're quite a broad company, so that's good. How do you scale it? I think you need like, fundamentally, you do need a little bit of structure and a little bit of a hierarchy. But on the whole, like, I think it's not that critical to most companies, and it's easy to default to it. It's easy to default to like a policy or like, I'm your boss and you need to do this. And usually that's actually just a patch for like a bigger root cause problem where they're missing the context or they're missing the freedom or you haven't empowered them. That's usually a sign of a bigger issue.
Mm. And I guess it just focuses the importance of democratizing decision-making and why pyramids just don't make sense.
Yeah. One of the critical things that run that, like the tree structures, you need everybody to hold everybody accountable. You need great feedback. You need great transparency.
Nothing is like lying. That's what just keeps ringing in my ear. Like,
yeah,
this whole idea and the importance of that. And if
imagine if you sold a car and you knew that it had like an issue and you just didn't say anything. Yeah, exactly. Like that, you would feel shit about that. You would know that you are lying, right? Like, and that's a really clear example. And most people like don't do that. But it's essentially the same thing when you're sitting, when I'm looking at you in the face and I'm watching you do something which I know is wrong or it's making me feel a certain way and you don't know that and I don't tell you, like I am just lying to you.
Even in a more like nuanced angle where you could be adding value, but you're scared to say something and you hold back and then you don't add that value and you never know.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it is having your team know that they can say to anybody at any point, I disagree, is a very powerful thing. Like that is, yeah, that needs to happen. Otherwise you never get to the right outcome.
And to get there though, as you mentioned, you need a density of talent. And I'm sure you've thought a lot about hiring people in the world.
Yeah.
So what's your process at Halter?
There's one line we always come back to, and that's if you're not headhunting, you're not hiring. You like, especially in a startup, you know, a lot of like, you don't have the huge pool of a Facebook or that type of stuff. And And a lot of the, like, the best people, it's cliche, a lot of the best people aren't looking. Like, you have to go actively network and kind of hunt these people out. And so, yeah, we, as a rule of thumb, we say, if you're a hiring manager, it's 20% of your time. Like, it's that important. You have to find effectively a day a week, or if not more, when it comes to hiring. So yeah, our process, we don't have, like, we try not to have processes, so it changes for everybody. And typically though, our hiring, like, set of steps or whatever is it's pretty lengthy. We take a lot of care. You meet a lot of different people, you meet a lot of the team, you do tech tests. Like, we think a lot about that, and we don't mind if a role is open for, you know, I think our longest role was an electrical engineer, which we only hired like a month or 2 months ago. And that was open for 8 months.
Wow.
Like, and credit to the hiring manager. He was desperate for help. Like, that team was absolutely slammed and working like some of the biggest hours in the company. And his ability to, like, walk out of an interview after like month six, and I don't know, hundreds of people he's met, and be like, nah, not right. It was like that. That is incredible.
Yeah.
Like, not once was the temptation to be like, oh, like, I know they'll be helpful. Like, I know they'll be able to, like, take a bit of the workload. And so, yeah, think a lot about hiring. I think everybody does though, and you can definitely get good at it, but I think everybody tries to hire well. And even the very, very best, you're only running at, what, like, if you were 70 to 80% hit rate of picking A players, that'd be like that's pretty good, I'd say. Anybody who claims to be higher than that, I'd probably say is lying. And so you get into this really tricky scenario where you need to hold your talent density high. Fundamentally, that underpins everything, right? If you want to be able to share context and transparency, you need people that you can trust. And if you don't want to have any process, you need people that are going to thrive in the environment. And A players only want to be around A players. So you will get it wrong, and then you're in a real tricky spot. And it's like, what do you do about someone that you've hired that within, you know, a couple of months, you're like, oh, damn it, I got that wrong. And sometimes the role was wrong. Sometimes you just didn't know enough. Sometimes, like, the match doesn't fit. And so, yeah, that's where you get into this tricky spot of, like, if you were to say it in a really bold way, it's like, well, how do you fire well? I think fire is probably a really loaded word, and comes with a lot of, if you're fired, it feels like a real bad thing. And I think often it's just, that's not true. Like, you can be an incredible performer, it's just not the right fit, or it's not a match. And so, yeah, I think often it's just a style mismatch, actually, when it comes to things like that. And so that's
fire fast.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think, actually listened to a podcast, and I think it was the CEO of Reddit was saying, like, when you hire someone, there's a chance that your company gets better. Like, you know, you hope you hire the right people, and you get a good person in, and if everything goes well, it gets better. When you fire someone, just because it's human nature, you always tend to, like, give people more and more chances and whatnot. When you fire someone, it's pretty much a guarantee that your company gets better, because, like, if anything, you just don't have to, it's not filling your mind anymore. You just don't have to think about that, like, that mismatch. Mm. And so I thought that, like, is an incredible way to think about it, but it is, yeah. In reality, I think the high talent density thing helps itself in this case, because often they never quite, like, bed in to the team. Like, if the mismatch is there, or they, like, the team kind of, like, churns through them in a way. Like, they never quite, like, keep up. They're always holding up the machine. And after a while, it's like, it's pretty evident to people. And they go like, man, this is like, just, it's just a bit chaotic for me, or it's a bit intense. Like, I don't thrive in this environment. And then they'll be like absolute stars at other companies. It's just like, for how, like, we run and our, like, level of chaos and speed and whatnot, it requires us, you know, a certain type of person.
It's almost like this idea of dating on both sides. That's why it's such a loaded word, fired.
Yeah, exactly. I feel pretty strongly about this, and I often talk to, you know, people outside of Holter about it, like my friends. And the other night I was explaining to somebody about, yeah, the notion of it being a mismatch. And the best example I had is, like, if I think I started this by saying, like, I could never work in a big corporate. And so if I somehow found myself working at, I'm an engineer, so if I somehow found myself working at, like, a Becker, as an example, and I just don't resonate with the process. I'm doing stuff that I don't believe in. I'm like, what? Like, why am I doing this? This is pointless. And if my manager came to me after 2 months and said like, hey, like, I think that this isn't a good fit. Like the way that you like to work, and I get it, and like kind of what I see you struggling with and how we run as a company, like we're not going to be able to shift the whole company to match that. And we're doing this for a reason. I don't think that like you're going to thrive here. I think if we carry on doing this, we'll go for a year and it's just like, it's not going to end well. How about you find like another job? Like, I think that notion is like, I would be like, hey, yeah, no one likes to be fired. Obviously the process sucks, but like that I think is very true. And if anything, it helps me find somewhere that I'm going to be better at like quicker. And often it's like a lot of people are too scared to also make that jump. So yeah, firing is a bad word for it.
You mentioned in an earlier chat that we had, you make a lot of culture based decisions. Mm-hmm. Can you dig a little bit deeper into that?
In its simplest form, this is like, I'm an engineer buying components from America and I'm booking shipping and I can put them on like, I can put them on the slow option and it will cost me $30, or I can put them on like DHL Express Premium and it's going to cost me $280. Like, what do I do?
Yeah.
And it's having the ability to be like, actually, that's going to save me 2 weeks. It's a critical component. That $280 is a no-brainer. Mm. I should definitely do that. And so that is, you know, one of our values is speed matters. We don't have a value which is like save, like we're all thrifty, but it's not like save money at all costs, or efficiency is important. Like efficiency, actually, speed is more important than efficiency. So like they are quite different principles as well. But so yeah, that's probably the courier example is like probably the simplest way that you can explain that. And there's no way as a manager I can be across all that stuff. I can't turn up to your desk and be like, oh no, make sure you put it on the fast plane or whatever it is. Like you can see how that doesn't scale, right? And so again, it's like context versus control, or yeah, culture-based decision-making.
And how do you sort of let that breathe throughout the entire organization?
I think it's really important that you have strong managers that you can get them on board with that. I think it's really important that you resist the urge to like come in and override like big decisions, and you have to let people kind of like run their own process and learn for themselves sometimes. And often, actually, the amount of times I've looked at stuff and been like, oof, I'm not sure I'd do it like that, but I've given you the context. Like, hey, it's actually, make sure you remember that super important this works. Like that is, I know we're moving fast, but also like the reliability of this is important. And then it turns out I'm just like, I'm completely wrong. I'm like, well, good work. That's epic. And that's, you know, it's so easy to come in and like just throw your voice around and make a big decision when you're not actually the best person to do that. And so I think, yeah, to allow culture-based decision-making to work, you have to remove the control or like the loudest voice decision-making as such. You've got to just get that out of the way and they'll fill it themselves with context.
I love that. I want to switch gears though. So where do we see Holter in 12 months?
12 months on like a meaningful percentage of the farms in New Zealand, if not in, you know, Europe and South America. I think like for us at the moment, it's really just getting collars on cows pretty much. Like we've got a massive pipeline, the product's there, they use it, they love it. And it's just really an execution piece for us, building the collars and putting them on cows, hiring the right people to help us do that. So definitely a big like growth phase for us. It's pretty exciting. The team's like super pumped. The vibe in the office has been incredible recently as we like finally kind of rubber hits the road as such and it's going. And definitely we talk a lot about other verticals, you know, not a cow. And that's pretty interesting. And there's some work that is kind of loosely there in the background, which we're all pretty excited about, which hopefully would make some good progress on in the next 12 months.
Exciting times ahead.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's good.
Thank you so much for joining me, Craig.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on.
Now it's time to listen to the earliest investor in Holter and the founder of Rocket Lab.
Well, listen, thank you so much for joining me today. What was it like to work with Craig when he joined Rocket Lab?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Craig joined Rocket Lab and reported directly to me. I'd have a small relationship with Craig while he was still at university. He'd pitched me an idea, and although the idea was rubbish, I could see that Craig had all the elements of what it takes to be a great entrepreneur. So we employed him and at Rocket Lab, and basically he just, you know, he learned and spent a lot of time with me and also, you know, other team members. So, you know, I think that's always good to, you know, if someone's looking at starting their own business and things, being thrown into an organization that's kind of like a giant chaotic startup, especially at that time, is, you know, it's a good kind of introduction to what it, you know, what it's like and what it's going to be. So I, you know, although the role wasn't officially an entrepreneur in residence, that's really how I viewed it, because I knew that we had Craig for a temporary period of time until he thought of his new idea.
I see. And just before we go on, can you please just make sure that your microphone is coming from your headphones? I'm just getting a little bit of feedback. Yeah. So you mentioned he was the entrepreneur in residence. What does that even entail in sort of the early days at Rocket Lab?
Well, I mean, you know, it wasn't an official title, but, you know, there's basically two things I'm passionate about here. And one is obviously space. And the other is trying to grow New Zealand and grow New Zealand's entrepreneurs. We have fantastic entrepreneurs here, but the environment they're cocooned in is somewhat, you know, limits the potential. So, you know, I've been very outspoken about what I think about the VC community and what's right and what's wrong, and trying to pull every lever that I can to, you know, to help the community. And I think it's a real shame. Like, where are all the billion-dollar Rocket Labs and Zeros? Where are they all? There's no reason we should have created heaps by now with the quality of entrepreneur we have.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, some of the founders even we've seen just started a fund in New Zealand. We're incredibly excited about the talent that has been for a while in New Zealand. And the ambition is just really starting to take off, which is super exciting.
Agree.
When did he first come to you with the idea of Halter? And what was the sort of pitch like?
Yeah, so prior to Halter, Craig had pitched me, you know, an idea which, like I say, I thought was rubbish, but he was, you know, you could see that he was going to go, he would realize that and do something differently, and he did. So you know, Craig left Rocket Lab, and, you know, he gave me a call one day and said, hey Pete, I've got this idea. So, you know, he came in and pitched it to me, and the moment I heard it's like, yep, now we've got a great entrepreneur with a great idea. This is going to be good. I'm in. Let me in.
What are some of the traits that you respect in entrepreneurs?
So there's really a few that are very obvious. So the first one is someone who is willing to work extraordinarily hard. You know, you don't create big things on Monday to Friday, 8 to 5. That just does not happen. You have to be willing to sacrifice everything to, you know, to work really hard and grow a business. Just also you need to be bold and think big and kind of undeterred by failure. I think those traits are all you need. A big idea and work hard. That's it. There's no more magic than that.
And then you obviously saw that in Craig, and you obviously think those are pretty important tenets to Halter's idea. How have you sort of seen that sort of play out as your relationship has grown with Craig?
Well, the wonderful thing about Craig and the team there is you can say something and Craig just goes, yep, I get it. So, you know, we all have a lot of war wounds from mistakes and things we've learned along the way of building a company. Some people are, you know, with, especially people who are very bold, it's a little bit more difficult to try and, you know, get ideas absorbed. Craig is a sponge. And he surrounds himself with people that have a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge, and just draws that. So the thing I love about, you know, being on the Halter board and an investor in that company and Craig in general is, you know, you can say something to Craig and he goes, yep, that makes sense. And then it's like instantly executed. There's not kind of a, you know, a big period of of kind of indecision, and it's just mm-hmm. it's just the advice is taken and it's executed immediately. And sometimes if the advice is you know, let's be honest, we not everybody gives the best advice, and sometimes mm-hmm. the advice you're giving can be, you don't have all the context to make it the best advice. But I think that is an important trait as an entrepreneur as well, is to know when to take the advice and to know when to say you're wrong. So I think that's something that's super impressive with Craig is, you know, Craig, we need to go and raise a big round. Yeah, we do. Okay, let's go. He's on a plane. So, you know, that is what makes a great entrepreneur.
Yeah. And how do you know who to take advice from? What are some of the filters that founders should be creating in their head so that they don't waste time listening to the wrong people?
Wow, this is the tricky thing, right? I mean, because there's, and I would say, and I, you know, I say this somewhat unashamedly, that the majority of the advice I ever received from New Zealand founders or people in the VC space was 100% wrong. So, you know, ultimately that's a decision that you have to make. You have to make as a founder is, okay, what are the things that this makes sense and what are the things that doesn't make sense? But I think it's always really important to get a global perspective. So, you know, I think that was one of the things that was really important for Holter is to bring in some, you know, global leaders from an investment standpoint, because, you know, one of the things I see in New Zealand a little bit is that someone will come up with an idea and they'll claim it's world class without actually going to the world to test whether it's world class. Mm. And I've seen a number of businesses where I've brought some of our investors down from Rocket Lab, and while they're down here, I'll say, hey, come and have a look at this company while you're here. And, you know, there's been another instances where they've gone, well, yeah, this is done 5 years ago by this company and blah, blah, blah. And it was just, you know, people have been working on this idea for years in New Zealand that had already been overdone. So, you know, the first thing I always say to an entrepreneur is get on a plane and go to where your market is and really find out if you're world class or not, because there's no point in chewing glass if you're not world class.
What do you think is world class about Holter?
Well, I mean, the whole approach here, if you know, farming is obviously, and dairy farming is a well understood, you know, environment in New Zealand. And it is something that is, there's been a lot of innovation in New Zealand, but there's been, you know, less kind of drastic disruption. So anything that is a large industry, I mean, as Craig will tell you, there's more cows on the planet than people. So, you know, anything that has, you know, the possibility of a large disruption in a really large market, I think is, those are the things that are very attractive.
You talked about the board. You've sort of spoken about how important it is to have a balanced board and at least have that global perspective. How did you think about forming that early board with Craig?
Well, if you look at the investors that Craig has around the board, you know, the majority of them are Rocket Lab investors as well. Mm. And so, you know, I strongly believe that the formation of your board is just incredibly important. If you have an engineering team and you hire rubbish engineers, you get a rubbish product. If you have a board and you hire rubbish board members or bring in rubbish investors, you have a rubbish company. Mm. So it's super critical to be very, very, very fussy on who you bring in as investors and board members. And I think that was one of the important things. And we've done this, you know, a few times now with New Zealand companies is to kind of do the flip and get in world-class VC Silicon Valley type folks that really inject that global thinking and that global access to capital and that global access to contacts. You know, the investors that Craig has around the table, if you want to meet anybody, a meeting can be arranged. So that is a very powerful tool to have in your toolbox.
Mm. Can you describe what a meeting might be like with you and the other investors in a Holter board meeting?
Well, I mean, we all see ourselves as investors as a resource for Craig. Mm. So this is one of the things that I found really unusual in New Zealand is a lot of entrepreneurs feel like they're reporting to the board and asking the board to make decisions. That's rubbish. The CEO has got a much better idea of what's going on than the board members. What the board members do is they have experience and they have contacts, and they can offer some select advice. So a board meeting, you know, for a whole board meeting is more about, as board members, how do we help Craig execute? How do we help Craig grow the company faster, take bigger market share? And, you know, Craig will task us to do things rather than us tasking Craig. I mean, this is the way it should be.
What are some of the mistakes you've seen from New Zealand entrepreneurs when they're thinking about creating a board?
I would say kind of, what would you call them? Kind of career boards people. You know, people who are on like 100 different boards, and they're just kind of, that's what they do, is they're on boards. And they're not bold. They're boring as anything. They're not bold. And, you know, are they really there to help the founder? And are they there to accept risk and do big things? So I see, and this is a gross generalization. There's some fantastic board members in New Zealand. So don't want to get anybody to get the wrong. Yeah, I know. I don't want to get the wrong. But I mean, you know, if you're in a startup, it's a way different kind of board member than it is in like a really established corporation. It's a way different board member. And you know, I expect, when I go on boards, and I don't do that many, but when I go on boards, I'm committing the small amount of kind of personal time that I have left to that. This is not, you don't just turn up to a board meeting and, you know, listen in and then say, try and sound important by saying a few words and then hang. No, you are there to work in a startup. So one of the traits that I see lacking the most in New Zealand boards, and this is a generalized statement in New Zealand boards, is boldness, willing to take risk and be bold. There's way too much conservatism amongst New Zealand boards that, you know, we'll just, you know, one foot in the other, will be, you know, very slowly and all the rest of it. I mean, if you have excess capital, you should just be taking that capital and putting it into the nuttiest ideas you can think of. And 99% of them are going to fail, but one of them might have the potential to outstrip the value of your business in total. So, you know, that ability to kind of think bigger and take some risk is the thing that I see lacking the most.
You sort of raise an interesting point, and there's the idea of spreading your bets, and with the capital that you have, throwing across a few different bets and diversifying, or solely focusing on one idea and one set of, I guess, core product elements. How do you think about the two? And is it different as the company grows, or
what? Totally. Totally. Now, the worst thing an entrepreneur can do is become kind of sidetracked. That is, and you see that too, right? Is that 80% of getting there is quick and easy, and then 20% just takes forever and is hard. And you get to that 80% point, and people start kind of, well, maybe it looks better to do this, or maybe we'll pivot out of this, and or whatever. So it's having the fortitude to just keep on grinding. So the worst thing you want to do is, you know, especially some founders get bored very easily. So as things start to slow down and get hard, and they just move on to the next idea, those are not the founders you want. You want the founders that will just grind and grind and grind and grind. And this is a good thing about Craig, is that you know that if there's a problem to be solved and you put Craig on it, he will just grind away until it's a stump. But the point that the time in a business for that more wasteful experimenting is once you have the product and you have this, then, and you're looking to grow, then you know what the challenges, one of the challenges not to fall into is that you have a product and it's successful, and then you stop innovating and stop thinking of new ideas. So that's the kind of the post-success, because you just, after the product, take X amount of cloud into these ideas and we'll see what happens.
And so now that it's a different phase, speaking to customers, launching with those customers and closing those customers, what have you learned from Rocket Lab that will be helpful?
Well, I think Craig is well positioned here, because the thing you know about Craig and the whole team there is they are as honest as the day is long. So, you know, I think there's a couple of key elements when you're dealing with customers. And, you know, firstly, it's honesty. So trying to play games and kind of complicated sales techniques and trickery and all that sort of stuff, it's just no. And you're not going to get that from Craig and the team there. At the end of the day, wonderful products almost sell themselves. So I'm not belittling the amount of work they have to do, but they have an incredibly, you know, distinct platform there that is really going to disrupt farming in general and save a tremendous amount of effort and stress. So, you know, it's really, you know, the team's job and they will do this well is to just not get too tricky and just bring a great product to market and people will want it and be honest and transparent with everybody.
Let's rewind back to Rocket Lab's time of knowing that they have a product that customers want. What were some of the war stories that you had gone through in closing those very first customers?
Well, I mean, we actually had a customer signed before we even had a term sheet for the Series A round. So, you know, if you build a great product that a lot of people need, then you know, you don't have to worry too much about that. If you build a rubbish product and you've got to push it to people, then that's when things get a little bit more difficult. But in saying that, you know, from a Rocket Lab perspective, we're not selling a SaaS service. We're not selling a widget. You know, we're delivering spacecraft orbit, and some of these spacecraft can be worth tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, it is a different kind of environment. But fundamentally, the one thing that is always the same is just being completely honest and transparent. You know, I think that is what we do here, and I think it serves us well. Is you know, we don't try and hide anything from our customers. Mm. We're always transparent about the vehicle, the risks, the mission, and then we work super hard. And I think those are the winning elements.
You mentioned in a TED talk last year that you were literally fighting physics every single day at Rocket Lab. Pretty awesome TED talk. Do you see any relationship with physics and company building?
Physics are hard laws. So physics, there is no bending of physics law. So that's very digital. However, there's a lot more shades of gray in building a company, a lot more shades of gray. Whereas physics, you know, it's one or zero. So no, I wouldn't liken it that much, because I think you know, building a company is all about okay decisions and gray areas. So some decisions you look back and, you know, you think that was exactly the right decision. Some decisions you look back on and you think that was exactly the wrong decisions. But more often than not, you'll look back and you'll think, well, maybe that was the best decision, maybe that wasn't. So I think it's a lot more gray and nuanced building a company.
From a team building perspective, that's certainly where a lot of the gray comes in. And we spoke about it with Craig, how if you're hiring a high density of talent, which is really what you need, a sort of high hit rate, if you're being honest with yourself, is 80% of the time, and hiring slow and firing fast. And even the word firing is an unusual word to be using. And we sort of likened it to dating and sort of working through that process together and seeing whether the employee and the employer, and it's the right sort of mix. Is that how you see it at Rocket Lab?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, your company is who you hire. It's not a logo or a brand or anything. It is 100% who you hire. And the success of Rocket Lab has been we hired the most amazing people and continue to do so. The bar is super high, and I am not ashamed of the fact that the bar is super high. And, you know, sometimes that's frustrating because some managers just need people, but we refuse to lower the bar. So, and then also that having a company full of A players ensures that the B players and the C players, you know, they don't you almost never need to take any action because they kind of get self-expelled by you know, the A players. So and I think this is kind of an uncomfortable area, right? Because you do build relationships with people, and you never want to see people fail. But also the other side of that is that, you know, sometimes people are failing, and if you're a startup, it's do or die. Like you cannot carry any kind of failure in areas of talent that just aren't performing, especially in the formative years. It just can't be done. Now, we have a big facility in the US as well, and in the US it's kind of a hire and fire at will state, and it's a very different work environment. Obviously, New Zealand is the complete opposite of that, and I think there is a balance to be had in the middle. You know, to being able to, you know, exit someone from a business is quite obviously, you know, the best thing for a business, but it's also sometimes the best thing, or quite often more than not, the best thing for the individual themselves if they're not performing and reaching their potential. So it's a bit of a tricky area, but unfortunately it's a little bit brutal with a startup is that, you know, you just have to select the best people and deselect the people that aren't performing and move on. That's the only way to do it.
And what are some of the qualities of those A-grade players, and how do you filter for that in the hiring process?
It's two things. It's just a work ethic and smart. Though, you know, those are really only the two things. Experience is great, but I will take somebody who is just incredibly sharp, incredibly motivated, over somebody who has 20 years experience and, you know, falls asleep during the lunch hour any day. But I'm a walking HR disaster. So I'm not even, every time I walk into the HR room, I think they lament. But I'm super lucky here at Rocket Lab to have someone like Sean O'Donnell who really looks after that much better than I ever could. But in the formative years, it's really tough. It is really, really tough, because especially in a startup, you bring people on and you're working in each other's pockets, and you build relationships with them and their families. And it's like, that is out of all of the things that you do as a company, for me personally anyway, that is always the hardest thing to do, is you see people who just have not managed to reach the bar, and you know, you have to take action against it. And that is an incredibly unpleasant thing. But you know, like I say, you just have to, otherwise the company will die. And yeah, it would be great to have more mechanisms. I think the 90-day trial was a really good thing, because both the employee and the employer had an understanding that, hey, this might not be the best place for me, and this might not be the best place for you. And at least everybody would go into that with an understanding that we were trying this out. And within 3 months, you generally determine that, you know, somebody is going to be just a winner or not. And they know that too. But, you know, now I think we actually have lost, we've certainly changed our hiring policies because of that. We spend a lot more time now, and we're far less likely to give someone a go. We will err on the side of caution and not hire versus giving somebody a go.
Well, listen, Peter, thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure having you on Wild Hearts.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us. If you have any questions or feedback, we'd love for you to send us an email, wildhearts@blackbird.vc. I hope you'll subscribe, and if you'd like the podcast, we'd be super grateful if you left us a review. Thank you so much for joining me, and I'll see you in a fortnight.